Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of February 20th. This week we feature a discussion of the book Fraternity by the author Diane Brady, which looks at a group of African Americans who attended the College of the Holy Cross, a Jesuit college up in Massachusetts, and how they were recruited to attend the school by Father John Brooks, who was at the time a professor of theology and administration and then later served for a long time as president of the school. Among those recruited to attend Holy Cross under Father Brooks were Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, the respected defense attorney Theodore Wells, Stanley Grayson, who has worked in New York City government, as well as the author Edward P. Jones. Some members of that class, as well as Father Brooks and Diane Brady, attended an event in New York recently, and we had a chance to sit down and talk with some of them. I spoke with Diane Brady, Theodore Wells, Father John Brooks, as well as Dr. Malcolm Joseph, Holy Cross, Class of 71.
Thank you all for coming and joining us. Maybe we'll start with Diane, and you can tell us a little bit about kind of what makes this story, this book, Fraternity, what's unique about it?
Well, I think it's unique that I think it was the fact that I didn't really know about this story. I was out at lunch with Stan Grayson, and it was the same day that Ted here was, I think, in the paper for representing Scooter Libby. It was a page one story, wasn't it, Ted? And basically Stan started talking about all the people who had lived on the hall with him at Holy Cross. He began speaking about Father Brooks, and I just became intrigued about the story, especially, you know, with Clarence Thomas and then with Ted in the news at the same time. I'd hoped it would come together more quickly, but it took quite a while to get Justice Thomas to sit down and speak with me.
Well, Mr. Wells, maybe you can speak a bit about how this happened. I mean, you were a young high school student, and Father Brooks, who was here, came and visited you. And why did you decide to go to Holy Cross?
I thought Holy Cross, at the time, offered me the best combination of a great academic education and the opportunity to play football. And I was looking for a combination of the two. And what it really ended up offering me was not only those two things, but the opportunity to meet Father Brooks and a number of other students who have become lifelong friends. I'm just so happy about the book, because what the book really is about is how Father Brooks took all of us under his wing at a time when he had 2,000 students to look after, and he looked after all of them. I want to emphasize that. But he really opened up his heart and gave us his time and really mentored us and became like a father to us.
I'm going to bring Dr. Joseph into the conversation. This was 1968. This was a very kind of charged time in American history. Martin Luther King had just been assassinated. So this was a difficult time to maybe go to a school where there were not a lot of African Americans on campus. What was that like?
It was a difficult time. My freshman year in 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And this past weekend, the New York Times did an obituary on Kevin White, who was the mayor of Boston at the time. And in the obituary, they point out that it was a very charged time in Boston, that there had been a law passed to, in fact, desegregate the schools at the time, one of the first in the nation for school desegregation. And that it was a very unpopular law, and it was a very tense time. So I was at Holy Cross at the time, and I didn't know what to expect after Martin Luther King was assassinated. And fortunately, it was peaceful. And I do recall at one point Father Brooks took several students. We went downtown to see a film related to the Civil Rights Movement. And so that was my first year at Holy Cross, and so I had anticipated, as Father Brooks was recruiting additional African-American students, I anticipated that there might actually be some tension, and eventually that, in fact, was the case. When I arrived at Holy Cross, and I mean this in a very positive way, I had very positive experiences with regard to my professors and the pre-medical students and the pre-dental students. But for example, my first week, a number of students asked if they could touch me. And they said it in a very positive way, because this one student pointed out, he said, I'd never met an African American, ever. And so I said yes. But then, in addition, there were other students that really probably weren't as kind. So my first year, for example, one of my classmates, who was a Jesuit priest, Dennis Yesolonia, Dennis asked me if any of the students had, if I'd heard any racial slurs, or if anyone had, in fact, harassed me. And I said no, when in fact, that's exactly what had happened. And so my preceptor, there was a Jesuit priest in each house, and my preceptor came to my room that night, and he asked me similar questions in a very positive way. And I said, Father, no one has said anything to me. And Father said, well, he said, Malcolm, you know, it would be no shame if you transferred to Fordham, because he knew that was from the Bronx. And he said, because I'm concerned about your safety. And when we had that conversation, the tone really changed at that point. I'm not sure what happened after then, but no one ever bothered me again, okay, from that perspective. So that was the environment in which I arrived at Holy Cross. And my sense of it was, as additional African-American men were recruited to the school, and Father Brooks actually sent me to Cardinal Hayes High School, which is where I graduated from. And I recruited two students to Holy Cross, James Gwynn and Henry Keith. And when they arrived, it was really a very different sense on campus, because I think this was the first time that there were more than, you know, two or three or four or five African-American men at the school simultaneously. And I think the rest is history.
Well, we want to get Father Brooks' thoughts on the matter. What came across when I was reading the book is, in 1968, I mean, it was a real urgent cause for you to go out and recruit and find students. What was the urgency behind it? Why did you feel like, was it the assassination of Dr. King? But you were also coming back from Rome, from Vatican II, and you were informed by the spirit there as well.
Well, if you took a view of the campus in those years, there was no shortage of problems. There were issues galore. Everyone had an issue. Students had issues. You get to Vietnam, the draft, everyone had a number. People are dropping out, going into the army. A year later, they're in Vietnam. It was a very serious concern. And then the country, of course, had problems up over their head with the race issues and with King's death. And I thought it just became time for us to do something at Holy Cross in terms of race relations. We were going nowhere. We had one or two students to dribble in every year. In the meantime, the president of the college had a lot of problems, too. We were not a healthy organization in terms of money in those days. The endowment was probably somewhere around $1 million or under $1 million. There was a new president in 1960, Father Swords. Father Swords was an immensely gifted president, and he made one decision. He was going to turn that school around and turn it into one of the finest undergraduate liberal arts schools. He was bent on that every way. He needed buildings, so he had to deal with the government to get some resident halls. He had to go to work, try to construct a development office. He did that. And a lot of people, I think sometimes when people read the book, they're not quite sure how positive he was. He was very positive. He was a quiet guy. He was a taskmaster, but he was supportive of the whole enterprise.
Right. He let you, he encouraged you to go out and do this recruiting.
He did. I confess, I was a little bit frightened. I think the morning I had to go in and tell him how much I had offered by way of scholarships.
He seemed to take it in stride.
Yeah. Well, he was a severe man in many ways, but he was an excellent Jesuit and a fine administrator.
Yeah.
So you had to be a little bit careful. He didn't always smile upon you or anything, but he was a great man.
It's interesting that you also wanted women at the same time.
Well, we tried that. When I was the academic dean, probably in 68 or 69, we took a shot at coeducation. We put it on the agenda for the trustees, and we got immediately wiped out. And we even lost a couple of trustees over the argumentation that was going on. But then in 70 I became president. I knew from day one that the first thing I was going to do was to get that agenda, that item back on the agenda.
Mr. Wells, one of the key parts of this story is this walkout that that happened, and that when you had this, maybe you can tell that story briefly about what that, the story behind it, and you know what the effect was for the students on campus.
Well, the walkout involved a situation where a student organization at Holy Cross, it was like the SDS, I forget the formal name of it, but they wanted to form a human blockade to prevent General Electric from recruiting Holy Cross students to work at GE. And this was because they thought GE was involved in the Vietnam War. And the members of that group had come to the Black Students Union and asked us if we would join in it and support it. We had a meeting, we decided not to formally join in it, not because we were not against the war, we very much were against the war, but we really thought we had other priorities and that was not the way to proceed. So as an organization, the BSU said we would not support the protest, the human shield, as they called it, but that if any Black student wanted to participate on his own, he was free to. What happened thereafter is that five Black students participated. Diane knows the numbers. I don't remember. I don't know. Is it 50 white students participated? At the end of the day, they chose for punishment four to five Black students, or five of the six Black students, and maybe eight or nine white students. And what really irked us and really got us really riled up was that the white students who were selected to be charged were the real leaders on campus of that organization. They were the organizers of that group that, again, I call it SDS, but it was
RSU,
something that,
right?
RSU, but they were really the campus leaders. Everybody knew them. And they kind of rolled the dice and took their chances knowingly, and God bless them. But the Black students were really just peripheral hanger-on figures like most of the white students that participated. And the notion that the Black students were being singled out and kind of paired with what we viewed as the leaders was just intolerable to us. Now, we were told that the Black students had been charged because they were more identifiable. I will say this in all candor. I have never in 40 years accepted that response because I know what happened that day, and the protest went on for over an hour or so, and they had everybody's picture. If you wanted to identify, Holy Cross was a very small community. Okay, they could have identified everybody if they wanted to, so I've never accepted that position. But regardless, at the end of the day, 80% of the Black students who participated were charged, and only a small percentage of the white students who occupied leadership positions were charged. And we were outraged and really thought what had taken place was so fundamentally wrong that the college should step up and admit that they had made a mistake in the charging decision and give amnesty to the Black students. They were there. There was no mistake. It just wasn't an alibi defense or something. We just didn't think they should have been singled out, especially since they had no leadership role. It was going to the college administrative board. I actually was asked by the Black students to represent them. It was my first case as a lawyer. I represented all five Black students who were charged. And I think the college board was a little taken aback that they had decided to have me speak as their lawyer. But we wanted to sharpen our position, really focus on the charging position. Ultimately, we were not sure that they were going to be given amnesty. As it turned out, they were not. And the issue really became how would the Black Student Union, the Black students react to what we thought was a fundamentally unfair decision by the college. And everybody, I think, thought we were going to take over an administration building because that seemed to be the protest movement of the day. But at a BSU meeting that night, a guy named Bob Deshay stood up at some point and said, you know what, if the college is this wrong, if they're this blind to the injustice of this moment, we should just leave because we're never going to be able to change their attitude. And and it just was an idea that caught on like wildfire. And every black student in that room, to a person, was on some type of scholarship, and felt so strongly about this issue that they were willing to give up their scholarships. And we decided that if the college did not reverse its position, we were going to quit school. And we ultimately did quit school, and now Father Brooks, God bless him, saved us and convinced the administration to review the issue and reconsider what had taken place. But I will say this, it was not a tactical decision in terms of we'll put pressure on the school and they'll repent. I'm sorry, change their mind. We really believed this was the right thing to do, and that we weren't going to occupy private property and take over a building, that this was such a fundamental issue of basic justice, we were willing to quit school.
Well, the full story is in Diane's book, so I'd recommend it to folks. Diane, maybe you can speak a bit about, you mentioned earlier Justice Thomas and trying to track down an interview with him. Obviously, that's a natural interest for people looking at this story. Well, what does this story tell us about him that perhaps people don't know about Justice Thomas?
I think it, to me, demonstrates a lot about the emotional state he was in. I mean, it's almost intriguing. Somebody who quits the seminary en route to becoming a priest would therefore immediately go to a Catholic college. Now, his argument is that was his only option, so that probably narrowed the choices somewhat. But I think it, to me, it's interesting to kind of look at the complexity of emotions that he felt. He obviously felt very differently about the world. He calls himself a radical in retrospect, and I find it very interesting that none of the other men look back and stereotype themselves in that way as being radical. What maybe their views have not changed so much. But I think it's to me it was very telling sort of perspective on how angry he was, how confused he was, but also the bonds that he formed there. I don't know how emotional he gets in daily life, but when I see him in public, he's somebody who's very self-contained, comes across sometimes as not a very emotional person. When you talk to him about Holy Cross, Father Brooks, Ted and Art, Malcolm Joseph here, he gets very emotional. I think it was a very special period of his life, and he feels a connection to these men that he doesn't necessarily feel he has that community at the moment. So I think it's just an interesting period of time. And then also, if you ask him how has it shaped his views on the court, he thinks fundamentally it was a very important period in his life for how he came to view the world, how he's made decisions, rightly or wrongly. He doesn't like to share that because everybody reads a lot between the lines when he says things like that. But important turning point, not one that he devoted much to in his own book either.
Yes, you write in your book, it was only 3 pages or so that he wrote about
it's
Holy Cross.
It's only a few pages, and I think that, you know, the purpose of his book perhaps was different. It was a testament to his grandfather. It was, I think, more cathartic about what had happened in the years since with Anita Hill and decisions on the court. I don't even pretend to project why he didn't spend that much time, but I think there's a disconnect when you read the section that he devotes to Holy Cross in his book, and you talk to him about his Holy Cross experience in this book, and then just last week, you know, I think he feels much more warmly and deeply toward the school than you might guess from reading his book.
Dr. Joseph, I'm wondering maybe you could speak to just the success that you've all had, the group of students who went to Holy Cross under the mentorship of Father Brooks. Looking back on it, are you still kind of impressed? You're a doctor yourself, obviously. Mr. Wells is a very respected litigator.
I am absolutely impressed. When you think that Ted went to Harvard Law School and Harvard Business School, Gil Hardy graduated from Yale Law School, Clarence graduated from Yale Law School. I went to Boston University School of Medicine, trained at Johns Hopkins, completed a master's degree in public health at Hopkins. When you think of the schools that we've all attended to and had very successful careers, I'm a retired Air Force colonel. When I was assigned at Andrews Air Force Base, I was assigned to the White House to Vice President Walter Mondale. I had the privilege of traveling with Coretta Scott King and Andrew Young and Benjamin Hooks to Nairobi, Kenya, to the funeral of Jomo Kenyatta as a part of that particular mission. All of those things have resulted as a result of Father Brooks and his love and affection for us. There was something special about the group at the time. I think we're all very goal-oriented. We were focused, and I think, as Ted said, he came to Holy Cross with a specific purpose in mind. I came to Holy Cross specifically to study in the pre-medical program, and I did. I was the first African-American graduate of their pre-medical program. Even looking back, I think it's a remarkable story, because today, the same success for anyone, for students anywhere, would be truly remarkable. We have literally covered the law, the legal profession, and we've traveled worldwide. We've affected many, many people. Justice Clarence Thomas is a friend, and he is complex, as we all are. I think, as was mentioned earlier, the book does create a tapestry that I think has not been seen before. But I think fundamentally, though, all of us have committed ourselves to doing all that we can to ensure that Father Brooks's legacy is true and on point. Truly a remarkable Jesuit priest, one that we love dearly.
Father Brooks, since we're talking for America Magazine here, I wonder if you could speak to just, you know, what is it about your Jesuit identity, your calling as a Jesuit, that kind of contributed to your work and your the work you did with these students?
Well, I was an undergraduate student at Holy Cross. It was the only college I ever really wanted to go to. I grew up in Boston, went to Boston a lot, and could have gone a lot of places maybe, but I always wanted Holy Cross. And then I lucked out as a Jesuit. I was there as a scholastic for a couple of years. Then I came back after finishing my doctorate, and I've been there ever since. So it's been very, very easy for me to position myself and to try to achieve things that I thought were going to help Holy Cross. I never made a decision that I didn't believe was in the best interest of Holy Cross. I wanted Holy Cross to be the very finest liberal arts school in the country. And every decision I made was based on that. And to introduce a larger number of black students to Holy Cross was part of that program. I mean, there was no great secret in 1967, 68 that we had to do something to attract African-American students to Holy Cross. And the efforts were not being, you know, no one was really taking them seriously. So that's why you have that crazy story of Jim Gallagher and myself driving around Philadelphia looking for students. Doesn't make any sense at all in terms of a decent program, but that's what we did.
But you did. You also targeted the Catholic schools, which I thought was interesting. And I think I've always been interested in the fact that, at least in New York, the Catholic high school network is not as strong as it was in the 60s. It might be because there's charter schools now or other alternatives. But I've wondered, you know, if that's a real loss. A lot of people I talk to think that it is. In many ways, because there was something extra that you
depends
got.
The schools, how good are they?
It depends, right?
The good ones.
I will tell you, I will speak to that, because I think the diminished enrollment in Catholic high schools and the fewer numbers of Catholic high schools, it has had a terrible impact on the minority community. When I was coming up in the 60s, Catholic high schools, and for that matter, you know, even Catholic elementary schools, they were a place where middle-class people, lower middle-class people, could afford to send their children to school if they didn't have a good public school in their neighborhood. And they provided a great education and great values, and those schools do not exist anymore. That infrastructure has been radically changed, and there's no question that there are attempts today by the charter schools to try to fill that void. But that is a void that has hurt in a very significant way both black and white middle class kids.
I agree. I grew up in the South Bronx in the, it's called the Patterson Projects, and So by any socioeconomic status, I guess we would be considered poor. But the Catholic schools and the Catholic education, in fact, Ted's point is the grammar school that I went to, St. Rita's, which was, St. Rita's is the Mission Center of the Impossible, St. Rita's was closed many, many years ago. My high school, Cardinal Hayes, still exists, and I think is doing reasonably well, but as with many Catholic high schools, it is at risk. But I think, though, and I agree with Ted, the values that we were inculcated with with our Catholic education are very significant. I'll close by saying one of the things that I was at the funeral of Armand Sr. at our parish several years ago. And the Cardinal Keeler, I met him after the funeral mass. Natalie served the mass and Malcolm served the mass, my children. So Cardinal Keeler asked me, he said, Dr. Joseph, where were you formed in your faith? And I said, Cardinal, I went to Holy Cross High School, Holy Cross College. And he said, well, I don't think it was Holy Cross. And I said, well, Cardinal, I went to Cardinal Hayes High School. And he said, I don't think it was Cardinal Hayes, to get to Ted's point. And I said, well, go back further. And I said, well, I went to St. Rita's. And he said, well, and I was trained by the Dominican nuns. He said, well, that's where you were formed.
Yeah.
And I remember that Sister said at one point, I think it was in the third grade, Sister said to all of us that we were all special and unique in the eyes of God. I'll never forget that. I believed it then, and I believe it now. And that's the difference in the context of an educational experience that I think many young people today never have.
I mean, I will say this, for your listeners, one of the things that your organization ought to be exploring is how do we get this book, Fraternity, written by Diane Brady, out to those Catholic schools that still exist? Because there's a story here that has the potential not only to inspire the students, but also the faculty. And just as we used to target the Catholic schools as a recruiting area for both black and white students, I would target those schools today as a place where we ought to get that book circulated.
That actually segues well into one of my final questions for Dan. This is a great story. What's the lesson for today? What are kind of the, for people reading it, you know, maybe young people in Catholic schools, what's the lesson here?
I do think it certainly raises a wistfulness and a nostalgia about the Catholic school network, but I think the power of leadership, you know, continues on. I also think it's very interesting to me. I'm not quite of the same generation. I was born in the late 60s. I feel very much when I talk to these men that the mantle of leadership was very strong upon their shoulders, that they knew the doors were opening, and all of them were prodigious workers. Eddie Jenkins took some issue in the book because he thinks he's, didn't have enough chronicling of the hours at the library that he spent. He does not compare to Ted, I must say, but it's true that there was a sense of not just destiny, but a real sense of responsibility, and I think that's something that every generation has to have, and I think it's something that when people look, you know, today, they wonder if the same sort of spirit, not just in minorities, but in the, you know, young people in general, if they're feeling both the opportunity and the responsibility to go out there and be leaders.
I just want to end with one question for Mr. Wells. The book starts with the assassination of Dr. King and the state of race relations in the country in 1968. Obviously, that seems like a long time ago. How do things stand in the country today versus then, and how have programs like what happened at Holy Cross helped kind of bring us to where we are today?
Well, I think the book is a testament to the benefits of an integrated society, and also to the results that affirmative action efforts can have. I think the country has advanced significantly from where it was in 1968, but after saying that, I will say very loudly that the issue of race in America continues to be one of this country's most significant issues, and it will continue to be so, I suspect, for the next 100 years. But it is a problem I think we will defeat. It's just going to take longer than I thought.
But it exists today, and it will continue to exist, and people of goodwill will continue to fight it, and they will succeed in defeating it.
Well, thank you all for taking part in this conversation. Thank you.